with me if they use it honestly. As a negotiator, you should strive for a reputation of being fair. Your reputation precedes you. Let it precede you in a way that paves success. How to discover the emotional drivers behind what the other party values. A few years ago, I stumbled upon the book How to Become a Rainmaker, and I like to review it occasionally to refresh my sense of the emotional drivers that fuel decisions. The book does a great job to explain the sales job not as a rational argument, but as an emotional framing job. If you can get the other party to reveal their problems, pain, and unmet objectives, if you can get at what people are really buying, then you can sell them a vision of their problem that leaves your proposal as the perfect solution. Look at this from the most basic level. What does a good babysitter sell, really? It's not childcare exactly, but a relaxed evening. A furnace salesperson? Cozy rooms for family time. A locksmith? A feeling of security. Know the emotional drivers, and you can frame the benefits of any deal in language that will resonate. Bend their reality. Take the same person, change one or two variables, and $100 can be a glorious victory or a vicious insult. Recognizing this phenomenon lets you bend reality from insult to victory. Let me give you an example. I have this coffee mug, red and white, with a Swiss flag. No chips, but used. What would you pay for it, deep down in your heart of hearts? You're probably going to say something like $3.50. Let's say it's your mug now. You're going to sell it to me. So tell me what it's worth. You're probably going to say something between $5 and $7. In both cases, it was the exact same mug. All I did was move the mug in relation to you, and I totally changed its value. Or imagine that I offer you $20 to run a 3-minute errand and get me a cup of coffee. You're going to think to yourself that $20 for 3 minutes is $400 an hour. You're going to be thrilled. What if then you find out that by getting you to run that errand, I made $1 million? You'd go from being ecstatic for making $400 an hour to being angry because you got ripped off. The value of the $20, just like the value of the coffee mug, didn't change, but your perspective of it did. Just by how I position the $20, I can make you happy or disgusted by it. I tell you that not to expose our decision-making as emotional and irrational. We've already seen that. What I am saying is that while our decisions may be largely irrational, that doesn't mean there aren't consistent patterns, principles, and rules behind how we act. And once you know those mental patterns, you start to see ways to influence them. By far the best theory for describing the principles of our irrational decisions is something called prospect theory. Created in 1979 by the psychologists Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky, prospect theory describes how people choose between options that involve risk, like in a negotiation. The theory argues that people are drawn to sure things over probabilities, even when the probability is a better choice. That's called the certainty effect. And people will take greater risks to avoid losses than to achieve gains. That's called loss aversion. That's why people who statistically have no need for insurance buy it. Or consider this. A person who's told he has a 95% chance of receiving $10,000 or a 100% chance of getting $9,499 will usually avoid risk and take the 100% certain safe choice, while the same person who's told he has a 95% chance of losing $10,000 or a 100% chance of losing $9,499 will make the opposite choice, risking the bigger 95% option to avoid the loss. The chance for loss incites more risk than the possibility of an equal gain. Over the next few pages, I'll explain a few prospect theory tactics you can use to your advantage. But first, let me leave you with a crucial lesson about loss aversion. In a tough negotiation, it's not enough to show the other party that you can deliver the thing they want. To get real leverage, you have to persuade them that they have something concrete to lose if the deal falls through. 1. Anchor their emotions. To bend your counterpart's reality, you have to start with the basics of empathy. So start out with an accusation audit, acknowledging all of their fears. By anchoring their emotions in preparation for a loss, you inflame the other side's loss aversion so that they'll jump at the chance to avoid it. On my first consulting project after leaving the FBI, I received the honor to train the National Hostage Negotiation Team for the United Arab Emirates. Unfortunately, the prestige of the assignment was tempered during the project by problems with the general contractor. I was a subcontractor. The problems became so bad that I was going to have to go back to the contractors I'd signed up, who normally got $2,000 a day, and tell them that for several months I could only offer $500. I knew exactly what they would do if I told them that straight out. They'd laugh me out of town. So I got each of them on the phone and hit them hard with an accusation audit. "I got a lousy proposition for you," I said, and paused until each asked me to go on. "By the time we get off the phone, you're going to think I'm a lousy businessman. You're going to think I can't budget or plan. You're going to think Chris Voss is a big talker. His first big project ever out of the FBI, he screws it up completely. He doesn't know how to run an operation, and he might even have lied to me." And then, once I'd anchored their emotions in a minefield of low expectations, I played on their loss aversion. "Still, I wanted to bring this opportunity to you before I took it to someone else," I said. Suddenly, their call wasn't about being cut from $2,000 to $500, but how not to lose $500 to some other guy. Every single one of them took the deal. No counteroffers, no complaints. Now, if I hadn't anchored their emotions low, their perception of $500 would have been totally different. If I'd just called and said, "I can give you $500 per day, what do you think?" they'd have taken it as an insult and slammed down the phone. 2. Let the other guy go first, most of the time. Now, it's clear that the benefits of anchoring emotions are great when it comes to bending your counterpart's reality. But going first is not necessarily the best thing when it comes to negotiating price. When the famous film director Billy Wilder went to hire the famous detective novelist Raymond Chandler to write the 1944 classic Double Indemnity, Chandler was new to Hollywood. But he came ready to negotiate, and in his meeting with Wilder and the movie's producer, Chandler made the first salary offer. He bluffly demanded $150 per week and warned Wilder that it might take him 3 weeks to finish the project. Wilder and the producer could barely stop from laughing because they had been planning to pay Chandler $750 per week, and they knew that movie scripts took months to write. Lucky for Chandler, Wilder and the producer valued their relationship with Chandler more than a few $100s. So they took pity on him and called an agent to represent Chandler in the negotiations. Similarly, I had a student named Jerry who royally screwed up his salary negotiation by going first. Let me say that this happened before he was my student. In an interview at a New York financial firm, he demanded $110,000, in part because it represented a 30% raise. It was only after he started that he realized that the firm had started everybody else in his program at $125,000. That's why I suggest you let the other side anchor monetary negotiations. The real issue is that neither side has perfect information going to the table. This often means you don't know enough to open with confidence. That's especially true any time you don't know the market value of what you're buying or selling, like with Jerry or Chandler. By letting them anchor, you also might get lucky. I've experienced many negotiations when the other party's first offer was higher than the closing figure I had in mind. If I'd gone first, they would have agreed, and I would have left with either the winner's curse or buyer's remorse. Those gut-wrenching feelings that you've overpaid or undersold. That said, you've got to be careful when you let the other guy anchor. You have to prepare yourself psychically to withstand the first offer. If the other guy's a pro, a shark, he's going to go for an extreme anchor in order to bend your reality. Then, when they come back with a merely absurd offer, it will seem reasonable, just like an expensive $400 iPhone seems reasonable, after they mark it down from a crazy $600. The tendency to be anchored by extreme numbers is a psychological quirk known as the anchor and adjustment effect. Researchers have discovered that we tend to make adjustments from our first reference points. For example, most people glimpsing 8 times 7 times 6 times 5 times 4 times 3 times 2 times 1 estimate that it yields a higher result than the same string in reverse order. That's because we focus on the first numbers and extrapolate. That's not to say never open. Rules like that are easy to remember, but like most simplistic approaches, they are not always good advice. If you're dealing with a rookie counterpart, you might be tempted to be the shark and throw out an extreme anchor. Or if you really know the market and you're dealing with an equally informed pro, you might offer a number just to make the negotiation go faster. Here's my personal advice on whether or not you want to be the shark that eats a rookie counterpart. Just remember, your reputation precedes you. I've run into CEOs whose reputation was to always badly beat their counterpart, and pretty soon, no one would deal with them. 3. Establish a range. While going first rarely helps, there is one way to seem to make an offer and bend their reality in the process. That is by alluding to a range. What I mean is this. When confronted with naming your terms or price, counter by recalling a similar deal which establishes your ballpark, albeit the best possible ballpark you wish to be in. Instead of saying, "I'm worth $110,000," Jerry might have said, "At top places like X Corp, people in this job get between $130,000 and $170,000. That gets your point across without moving the other party into a defensive position, and it gets him thinking at higher levels. Research shows that people who hear extreme anchors unconsciously adjust their expectations in the direction of the opening number. Many even go directly to their price limit. If Jerry had given this range, the firm probably would have offered him $130,000 because it looked so cheap next to $170,000. In a recent study, Columbia Business School psychologists found that job applicants who named a range received significantly higher overall salaries than those who offered a number, especially if their range was a bolstering range, in which the low number in the range was what they actually wanted. Understand, if you offer a range, and it's a good idea to do so, expect them to come in at the low end. 4. Pivot to non-monetary terms. People get hung up on how much. But don't deal with numbers in isolation. That leads to bargaining, a series of rigid positions defined by emotional views of fairness and pride. Negotiation is a more intricate and subtle dynamic than that. One of the easiest ways to bend your counterpart's reality to your point of view is by pivoting to non-monetary terms. After you've anchored them high, you can make your offer seem reasonable by offering things that aren't important to you but could be important to them. Or, if their offer is low, you could ask for things that matter more to you than them. Since this is sometimes difficult, what we often do is throw out examples to start the brainstorming process. Not long ago, I did some training for the Memphis Bar Association. Normally, for the training they were looking for, I'd charge $25,000 a day. They came in with a much lower offer that I balked at. Then they offered to do a cover story about me in their association magazine. For me to be on the cover of a magazine that went out to who knows how many of the country's top lawyers was priceless advertising. Plus, my mom is really proud of it. They had to put something on the cover anyway, so it had zero cost to them, and I gave them a steep discount on my fee. I constantly use that as an example in my negotiations now when I name a price. I want to stimulate my counterpart's brainstorming to see what valuable non-monetary gems they might have that are cheap to them, but valuable to me. 5. When you do talk numbers, use odd ones. Every number has a psychological significance that goes beyond its value. And I'm not just talking about how you love 17 because you think it's lucky. What I mean is that in terms of negotiation, some numbers appear more immovable than others. The biggest thing to remember is that numbers that end in zero inevitably feel like temporary placeholders, guesstimates that you can easily be negotiated off of. But anything you throw out that sounds less rounded, say $37,263, feels like a figure that you came to as a result of thoughtful calculation. Such numbers feel serious and permanent to your counterpart, so use them to fortify your offers. 6. Surprise with a gift. You can get your counterpart into a mood of generosity by staking an extreme anchor and then, after their inevitable first rejection, offering them a wholly unrelated surprise gift. Unexpected conciliatory gestures like this are hugely effective because they introduce a dynamic called reciprocity. The other party feels the need to answer your generosity in kind. They will suddenly come up on their offer, or they'll look to repay your kindness in the future. People feel obliged to repay debts of kindness. Look at it in terms of international politics. In 1977, Egyptian President Anwar Sadat dramatically pushed negotiations on the Egypt-Israel peace treaty forward by making a surprise address to the Israeli Knesset, a generous gesture that did not involve making any actual concessions, but did signify a big step toward peace. Back in Haiti, a few hours after the kidnappers had snatched his aunt, I was on the phone with the politician's nephew. There was no way their family could come up with $150,000, he told me, but they could pay between $50,000 and $85,000. But since learning that the ransom was just party money, I was aiming much lower, $5,000. We were not going to compromise. It was a matter of professional pride. I advised him to start off by anchoring the conversation in the idea that he didn't have the money, but to do so without saying no so as not to hit their pride head on. How am I supposed to do that? He asked in the next call. The kidnapper made another general threat against the aunt and again demanded the cash. That's when I had the nephew subtly question the kidnapper's fairness. I'm sorry, the nephew responded, but how are we supposed to pay if you're going to hurt her? That brought up the aunt's death, which was the thing the kidnappers most wanted to avoid. They needed to keep her unharmed if they hoped to get any money. They were commodity traders, after all. Notice that to this point the nephew hadn't named a price. This game of attrition finally pushed the kidnappers to name a number first. Without prodding, they dropped to $50,000. Now that the kidnapper's reality had been bent to a smaller number, my colleagues and I told the nephew to stand his ground. How can I come up with that kind of money? We told him to ask. Again the kidnapper dropped his demand to $25,000. Now that we had him in our sights, we had the nephew make his first offer, an extreme low anchor of $3,000. The line went silent and the nephew began to sweat profusely, but we told him to hold tight. This always happened at the moment the kidnapper's economic reality got totally rearranged. When he spoke again, the kidnapper seemed shell-shocked, but he went on. His next offer was lower, $10,000. Then we had the nephew answer with a strange number that seemed to come from deep calculation of what his aunt's life was worth, $4,751. His new price? $7,500. In response, we had the cousin spontaneously say he'd throw in a new portable CD stereo and repeated the $4,751. The kidnappers, who didn't really want the CD stereo, felt there was no more money to be had, said yes. 6 hours later, the family paid that sum, and the aunt came back home safely. How to negotiate a better salary. One of the critical factors in business school rankings is how well their graduates are compensated. So I tell every MBA class I lecture that my first objective is to single-handedly raise the ranking of their school by teaching them how to negotiate a better salary. I break down the process into three parts that blend this chapter's dynamics in a way that not only brings you better money, but convinces your boss to fight to get it for you. Be pleasantly persistent on non-salary terms. Pleasant persistence is a kind of emotional anchoring that creates empathy with the boss and builds the right psychological environment for constructive discussion. And the more you talk about non-salary terms, the more likely you are to hear the full range of their options. If they can't meet your non-salary requests, they may even counter with more money, like they did with a French-born American former student of mine. She kept asking, with a big smile, for an extra week of vacation beyond what the company normally gave. She was French, she said, And that's what French people did. The hiring company was completely handcuffed on the vacation issue, but because she was so darn delightful, and because she introduced a non-monetary variable into the notion of her value, they countered by increasing her salary offer. Salary terms without success terms is Russian roulette. Once you've negotiated a salary, make sure to define success for your position, as well as metrics for your next raise. That's meaningful for you and free for your boss, much like giving me a magazine cover story was for the Bar Association. It gets you a planned raise and, by defining your success in relation to your boss's supervision, it leads into the next step. Spark their interest in your success and gain an unofficial mentor. Remember the idea of figuring what the other side is really buying? Well, when you are selling yourself to a manager, sell yourself as more than a body for a job. Sell yourself and your success as a way they can validate their own intelligence and broadcast it to the rest of the company. Make sure they know you'll act as a flesh-and-blood argument for their importance. Once you've bent their reality to include you as their ambassador, they'll have a stake in your success. Ask, what does it take to be successful here? Please notice that this question is similar to questions that are suggested by many MBA career counseling centers, yet not exactly the same. And it's the exact wording of this question that's critical. Students from my MBA courses who have asked this question in job interviews have actually had interviewers lean forward and say, "No one ever asked us that before." The interviewer then gave a great and detailed answer. The key issue here is if someone gives you guidance, they will watch to see if you follow their advice. They will have a personal stake in seeing you succeed. You have just recruited your first unofficial mentor. To show how this can be done to near perfection, I can think of no better example than my former MBA student, Angel Prado. While Angel was finishing up his MBA, he went to his boss and began to lay the groundwork for his work post-MBA, which the company was paying. During his last semester, he set a non-specific anchor, a kind of range, by suggesting to his boss that once he graduated and the company was done investing in his MBA, around $31,000 per year, that money should go to him as salary. His boss made no commitment, but Angel was pleasantly persistent about it, which set the idea as an anchor in his boss's mind. Upon graduation, Angel and his boss had their big sit-down. In an assertive and calm manner, Angel broached a non-financial issue to move the focus away from how much. He asked for a new title. Angel's boss readily agreed that a new role was a no-brainer after Angel's new degree. At that point, Angel and his manager defined what his roles and responsibilities would be in his new role, thereby setting success metrics. Then Angel took a breath and paused so that his boss would be the first to throw out a number. At last he did. Curiously enough, the number showed that Angel's earlier efforts at anchoring had worked. He proposed to add $31,000 to Angel's base salary, almost a 50% raise. But Angel was no rookie negotiator, not after taking my class. So instead of countering and getting stuck in how much, he kept talking, labeling the boss's emotions and empathizing with his situation at the time the company was going through difficult negotiations with its investors. And then Angel courteously asked for a moment to step away and print up the agreed-upon job description. This pause created a dynamic of pre-deadline urgency in his boss, which Angel exploited when he returned with the printout. On the bottom, he'd added his desired compensation, $134.5K to $143K. In that one little move, Angel weaved together a bunch of the lessons from this chapter. The odd numbers gave them the weight of thoughtful calculation. The numbers were high, too, which exploited his boss's natural tendency to go directly to his price limit when faced by an extreme anchor. And they were a range which made Angel seem less aggressive and the lower end more reasonable in comparison. From his boss's body language, raised eyebrows, it was clear that he was surprised by the compensation request. But it had the desired effect. After some comments about the description, he countered with $120,000. Angel didn't say no or yes, but kept talking and creating empathy. Then, in the middle of a sentence, seemingly out of the blue, his boss threw out $127,000. With his boss obviously negotiating with himself, Angel kept him going. Finally, his boss said he agreed with the $134,500 and would pay that salary starting in 3 months, contingent on the board of directors' approval. As the icing on the cake, Angel worked in a positive use of the word fair. "That's fair," he said, and then sold the raise to his boss as a marriage in which his boss would be the mentor. "I'm asking you, not the board, for the promotion, and all I need is for you to agree with it," he said. And how did Angel's boss reply to his new ambassador? "I'll fight to get you this salary. So follow Angel's lead and make it rain." Key lessons. Compared to the tools discussed in previous chapters, the techniques here seem concrete and easy to use. But many people shy away from them because they seem manipulative. Something that bends your counterpart's reality must be cheating, right? In response, let me just say that these tools are used by all the best negotiators because they simply recognize the human psyche as it is. We are emotional, irrational beasts who are emotional and irrational in predictable, pattern-filled ways. Using that knowledge is only, well, rational. As you work these tools into your daily life, remember the following powerful lessons. All negotiations are defined by a network of subterranean desires and needs. Don't let yourself be fooled by the surface. Once you know that the Haitian kidnappers just want party money, you will be miles better prepared. Splitting the difference is wearing one black and one brown shoe, so don't compromise. Meeting halfway often leads to bad deals for both sides. Approaching deadlines entice people to rush the negotiating process and do impulsive things that are against their best interests. The F word, fair, is an emotional term people usually exploit to put the other side on the defensive and gain concessions. When your counterpart drops the F-bomb, don't get suckered into a concession. Instead, ask them to explain how you're mistreating them. You can bend your counterpart's reality by anchoring his starting point. Before you make an offer, emotionally anchor them by saying how bad it will be. When you get to numbers, set an extreme anchor to make your real offer seem reasonable, or use a range to seem less aggressive. The real value of anything depends on what vantage point you're looking at it from. People will take more risks to avoid a loss than to realize a gain. Make sure your counterpart sees that there is something to lose by inaction. Chapter 7. Create the Illusion of Control. A month after I'd finished working the case of Jeffrey Schilling in May 2001, I got orders from headquarters to head back to Manila. The same bad guys who'd taken Schilling, a brutal group of radical Islamists named the Abu Sayyaf, had raided the Dos Palmas private diving resort and taken 20 hostages, including three Americans, Martin and Gracia Burnham, a missionary couple from Wichita, Kansas, and Guillermo Sobero, a guy who ran a California waterproofing firm. Dos Palmas was a negotiator's nightmare from the start. The day after the kidnappings, the recently elected Philippine president, Gloria Macapagal Arroyo, set up the most confrontational, non-constructive dynamic possible by publicly declaring all-out war on the Abu Sayyaf. Not exactly empathetic discourse, right? It got a lot worse. The Philippine Army and Marines had a turf war in the midst of the negotiations, pissing off the kidnappers with several botched raids. Because American hostages were involved, the CIA, the FBI, and U.S. military intelligence were all called in, and we too squabbled among ourselves. Then the kidnappers raped and killed several hostages, 9/11 happened, and the Abu Sayyaf was linked to Al-Qaeda. By the time the crisis concluded in an orgy of gunshots in June 2002, Dos Palmas had officially become the biggest failure in my professional life. To call it a train wreck would be generous, if you know what I mean. But failures plant the seeds of future success, and our failure in the Philippines was no exception. If the Dos Palmas calamity showed me anything, it was that we all were still suffering under the notion that negotiation was a wrestling match where the point is to exhaust your opponent into submission, hope for the best, and never back down. As my disappointment with Dos Palmas forced me to reckon with our failed techniques, I took a deep look into the newest negotiating theories, some great and some completely harebrained, and I had a chance encounter with a case in Pittsburgh that completely changed how I looked at the interpersonal dynamics of negotiation conversations. From the ashes of Dos Palmas, then, we learned a lesson that would forever change how the FBI negotiated kidnappings. We learned that negotiation was coaxing, not overcoming. Co-opting, not defeating. Most important, we learned that successful negotiation involved getting your counterpart to do the work for you and suggest your solution himself. It involved giving him the illusion of control while you, in fact, were the one defining the conversation. The tool we developed is something I call the calibrated or open-ended question. What it does is remove aggression from conversations by acknowledging the other side openly without resistance. In doing so, it lets you introduce ideas and requests without sounding pushy. It allows you to nudge. I'll explain it in depth later on, but for now let me say that it's really as simple as removing the hostility from the statement, "You can't leave," and turning it into a question. What do you hope to achieve by going? Don't try to negotiate in a firefight. The moment I arrived in Manila on the Burnham Sabero case, I was sent down to the Mindanao region, where the Philippine military was lobbing bullets and rockets into a hospital complex where the Abu Sayyaf and the hostages were holed up. This was no place for a negotiator because it's impossible to have a dialogue in the middle of a firefight. Then things got worse. When I woke up the next morning, I learned that during the night the kidnappers had taken their hostages and escaped. The escape was the first sign that this operation was going to be a rolling train wreck, and that the Philippine military was less than a trustworthy partner. During debriefings following the episode, it was revealed that during a ceasefire, a military guy had collected a suitcase from thugs in the hospital, and not long after that, all the soldiers on the rear perimeter of the hospital had been called away for a meeting. Coincidentally, or not, the bad guys chose that moment to slip away. Things really blew up 2 weeks later, on the Philippines' Independence Day, when Abu Sabaya announced that he was going to behead one of the whites unless the government called off its manhunt by midday. We knew this meant one of the Americans and anticipated it would be Guillermo Sabero. We didn't have any direct contact with the kidnappers at the time because our partners in the Philippine military had assigned us an intermediary who always forgot to make sure we were present for his phone calls with the kidnappers, and similarly forgot to tape them. All we could do was send text messages offering to schedule a time to speak. What ended up happening was that just before the noon deadline, Sabaya and a member of the Philippine presidential cabinet had a conversation on a radio talk show, and the government conceded to Sabaya's demand to name a Malaysian senator as a negotiator. In exchange, Sabaya agreed not to kill a hostage. But it was too late to fix this atmosphere of confrontation, distrust, and lies. That afternoon, the hostages heard Sabaya on the phone yelling, "But that was part of the agreement! That was part of the agreement!" Not long after, the Abu Sayyaf beheaded Guillermo Sabero, and for good measure, the group took 15 more hostages. With none of the important moving parts anywhere near under our control, and the United States largely uninterested in spite of Sabero's murder, I headed back to Washington, D.C. It seemed like there was little we could do. Then, 9/11 changed everything. Once a minor terrorist outfit, the Abu Sayyaf was suddenly linked to Al-Qaeda. And then a Philippine TV reporter named Arlen de la Cruz got into the Abu Sayyaf camp and videotaped Sabaya as he taunted the American missionaries Martin and Gracia Burnham who were so emaciated they looked like concentration camp survivors. The video hit the U.S. news media like thunder. Suddenly, the case became a major U.S. government priority. There is always a team on the other side. The FBI sent me back in. Now I was sent in to make sure a deal got made. It was all very high profile, too. Some of my contacts reported that FBI Director Robert Mueller was personally briefing President George W. Bush every morning on what we were doing. When Director Mueller showed up in the U.S. Embassy in Manila and I was introduced to him, a look of recognition came over his face. That was a very heady moment. But all the support in the world won't work if your counterpart's team is dysfunctional. If your negotiation efforts don't reach past your counterpart and into the team behind him, then you've got a hope-based deal. And hope is not a strategy. One of the things I failed to fully appreciate then was that the kidnappers had changed negotiators themselves. Sabaya had been replaced. My boss, Gary Nesner, had, in a previous kidnapping, pointed out to me that a change in negotiators by the other side almost always signaled that they meant to take a harder line. What I didn't realize at the time was this meant Sabaya was going to play a role as a deal-breaker if he wasn't accounted for. Our new tack was to buy the Burnhams back. Although the United States officially doesn't pay ransoms, a donor had been found who would provide $300,000. The new Abu Sayyaf negotiator agreed to a release. The ransom drop was a disaster. The kidnappers decided that they wouldn't release the Burnhams, or rather, Sabaya, who was physically in charge of the hostages, refused to release them. He had cut his own side deal, one we didn't know about, and it had fallen through. The new negotiator, now embarrassed and in a foul mood, covered himself by claiming that the payment was short $600. We were baffled. $600? You won't let hostages go because of $600? And we tried to argue that if the money was missing, it must have been the courier who had stolen the money. But we had no dynamic of trust and cooperation to back us up. The $300,000 was gone, and we were back to rarely answered text messages. The slow-motion wreck culminated about 2 months later with a botched rescue. A team of Philippine scout rangers walking around in the woods came across the Abu Sayyaf camp. Or so they said. Later we heard another government agency had tipped them off. That other government agency, OGA, had not told us about their location because? Why? That's something I will never understand. The scout rangers formed a skirmish line from a tree line above the camp and opened fire, indiscriminately pouring bullets into the area. Gracia and Martin were taking a nap in their hammocks when the fire started raining down. They both fell out of their hammocks and started to roll down the hill towards safety. But as a sheet of bullets from their rescuers fell on them, Gracia felt a searing burn flare through her right thigh. And then she felt Martin go limp. Minutes later, after the last rebels fled, the squad of Philippine soldiers tried to reassure Gracia that her husband was fine, but she shook her head. After a year in captivity, she had no time for fantasies. Gracia knew her husband was dead, and she was right. He'd been hit in the chest 3 times by friendly fire. In the end, the supposed rescue mission killed 2 of the 3 hostages there that day. A Philippine nurse named Edibora Yap also died. And the big fish, Sabaya, escaped to live a few more months. From beginning to end, the 13-month mission was a complete failure, a waste of lives and treasure. As I sat in the dark at home a few days later, dispirited and spent, I knew that something had to change. We couldn't let this happen again. If the hostages' deaths were going to mean something, we would have to find a new way to negotiate, communicate, listen and speak, both with our enemies and with our friends. Not for communication's sake, though. No. We had to do it to win. Avoid a shutdown. No two ways about it, my return to the United States was a time of reckoning. I questioned, I even doubted, some of what we were doing at the FBI. If what we knew wasn't enough, we had to get better. The real kick in the pants came after my return when I was reviewing information about the case, a lot of which we hadn't had in the field. Among the piles of information was one fact that totally blew my mind. Martin Burnham had been overheard on a phone call to someone. I wondered what in God's name our hostage was doing talking on the phone without us knowing. And with whom was he talking? There's only one reason a hostage ever gets on a phone. It's to provide proof of life. Someone else had been trying to ransom the Burnhams out. It turned out to be someone working for a crooked Philippine politician who'd been running a parallel negotiation for the Burnhams' release. He wanted to buy the hostages out himself in order to show up Philippine President Arroyo. But it wasn't so much that this guy was going behind our backs that bothered me. As is pretty clear already, there were a whole lot of underhanded things going on. What really ate at me was that this schmuck, who wasn't an FBI-trained hostage negotiator, had pulled off something that I hadn't been able to do. He'd gotten to speak to Martin Burnham on the phone. For free. That's when I realized that this Crooked Paul's success, where we had failed, was a kind of metaphor for everything that was wrong with our one-dimensional mindset. Beyond our problems with the Philippine military, the big reason we had no effective influence with the kidnappers and hostages was that we had this very tit-for-tat mentality. Under that mentality, if we called up the bad guys, we were asking for something, and if they gave it to us, we had to give them something back. And so, because we were positive that the Burnhams were alive, we'd never bothered to call and ask for proof of life. We were afraid to go into debt. If we made an ask and they granted it, we'd owe. Not making good on a debt risked the accusation of bad faith negotiation, and bad faith in kidnappings gets people killed. And of course we didn't ask the kidnappers to talk directly to the hostage because we knew they'd say no, and we were afraid of being embarrassed. That fear was a major flaw in our negotiating mindset. There is some information that you can get only through direct, extended interactions with your counterpart. We also needed new ways to get things without asking for them. We needed to finesse making an ask with something more sophisticated than closed-ended questions with their yes-no dynamic. That's when I realized that what we had been doing wasn't communication. It was verbal flexing. We wanted them to see things our way, and they wanted us to see it their way. If you let this dynamic loose in the real world, negotiation breaks down and tensions flare. That whole ethos permeated everything the FBI was doing. Everything was a showdown, and it didn't work. Our approach to proof-of-life questions embodied all these problems. At the time, we proved that our hostages were alive by devising questions that asked for a piece of information only the hostage could know. Computer security-style questions like, what's the name of Martin's first dog, or what's Martin's dad's middle name? This particular type of question had many failings, however. For one thing, it had sort of become a signature of law enforcement in the kidnapping world. When a family starts asking a question of that type, it's a near certainty that the cops are coaching them. And that makes kidnappers very nervous. Even beyond the nerves, you had the problem that answering questions like those required little, if any, effort. The bad guys go and get the fact and give it to you right away because it's so easy. Bang, bang, bang. It happens so fast that you don't gain any tactical advantage, any usable information, any effort on their part toward a goal that serves you. And all negotiation, done well, should be an information-gathering process that vests your counterpart in an outcome that serves you. Worst of all, the bad guys know that they have just given you something, a proof of life, which triggers this whole human reciprocity gene. Whether we like to recognize it or not, a universal rule of human nature across all cultures is that when somebody gives you something, they expect something in return, and they won't give anything else until you pay them back. Now, we didn't want to trigger this whole reciprocity thing because we didn't want to give anything. So what happened? All of our conversations became these paralyzed confrontations between two parties who wanted to extract something from each other, but didn't want to give. We didn't communicate out of pride and fear. That's why we failed, while numbskulls like this crooked Philippine politician just stumbled in and got what we so desperately needed. That is, communication without reciprocity. I sat back and wondered to myself, how the hell do we do that? Suspend unbelief. While I was racking my brains over how this sleazy politician managed to get Martin Burnham on the phone while we never could, FBI Pittsburgh had a kidnapping case. My partner Chuck brought me the tapes from the case because he thought it was funny. You see, one Pittsburgh drug dealer had kidnapped the girlfriend of another Pittsburgh drug dealer. And for whatever reason, the victim drug dealer came to the FBI for help. Coming to the FBI seemed kind of contrary to his best interests, being a drug dealer and all. But he did it because no matter who you are, when you need help, you go to the FBI, right? On the tapes, our hostage negotiators are riding around with this drug dealer while he's negotiating with the other drug dealer. Normally, we would have had the guy ask a bulletproof proof-of-life question like, what was the name of the girlfriend's teddy bear when she was little? But in this situation, this drug dealer hadn't yet been coached on asking a correct question. So, in the middle of the conversation with the kidnapper, he just blurts, "Hey, dog, how do I know she's all right?" And the funniest thing happened. The kidnapper actually went silent for 10 seconds. He was completely taken aback. Then he said, in a much less confrontational tone of voice, "Well, I'll put her on the phone." I was floored because this unsophisticated drug dealer just pulled off a phenomenal victory in the negotiation. To get the kidnapper to volunteer to put the victim on the phone is massively huge. That's when I had my holy shit moment and realized that this is the technique I'd been waiting for. Instead of asking some closed-ended question with a single correct answer, he'd ask an open-ended, yet calibrated one, that forced the other guy to pause and actually think about how to solve the problem. I thought to myself, this is perfect. It's a natural and normal question, not a request for a fact. It's a how question. And how engages because how asks for help. Best of all, he doesn't know the kidnapper a damn thing. The guy volunteers to put the girlfriend on the phone. He thinks it's his idea. The guy who just offered to put the girlfriend on the line thinks he's in control. And the secret to gaining the upper hand in a negotiation is giving the other side the illusion of control. The genius of this technique is really well explained by something that the psychologist Kevin Dutton says in his book, Split Second Persuasion. He talks about what he calls unbelief, which is active resistance to what the other side is saying, complete rejection. That's where the two parties in a negotiation usually start. If you don't ever get off that dynamic, you end up having showdowns, as each side tries to impose its point of view. You get two hard skulls banging against each other, like in Dos Palmas. But if you can get the other side to drop their unbelief, you can slowly work them to your point of view on the back of their energy, just like the drug dealer's question got the kidnapper to volunteer to do what the drug dealer wanted. You don't directly persuade them to see your ideas. Instead, you ride them to your ideas. As the saying goes, the best way to ride a horse is in the direction in which it is going. Our job as persuaders is easier than we think. It's not to get others believing what we say. It's just to stop them unbelieving. Once we achieve that, the game's half won. Unbelief is the friction that keeps persuasion in check, Dutton says. Without it, there'd be no limits. Giving your counterpart the illusion of control by asking calibrated questions, by asking for help, is one of the most powerful tools for suspending unbelief. Not long ago, I read this great article in the New York Times by a medical student who was faced with a patient who had ripped out his IV, packed his bags, and was making a move to leave because his biopsy results were days late and he was tired of waiting. Just then, a senior physician arrived. After calmly offering the patient a glass of water and asking if they could chat for a minute, he said he understood why the patient was pissed off and promised to call the lab to see why the results were delayed. But what he did next is what really suspended the patient's unbelief. He asked a calibrated question. what he felt was so important about leaving. And then when the patient said he had errands to handle, the doctor offered to connect the patient with services that could help him get them done. And boom, the patient volunteered to stay. What's so powerful about the senior doctor's technique is that he took what was a showdown, I'm going to leave versus you can't leave, and asked questions that led the patient to solve his own problem, in the way the doctor wanted. It was still a kind of showdown, of course, but the doctor took the confrontation and bravado out of it by giving the patient the illusion of control. As an old Washington Post editor named Robert Estabrook once said, "He who has learned to disagree without being disagreeable has discovered the most valuable secret of negotiation." This same technique for suspending unbelief that you use with kidnappers and escaping patients works for anything, even negotiating prices. When you go into a store, instead of telling the sales clerk what you need, you can describe what you're looking for and ask for suggestions. Then, once you've picked out what you want, instead of hitting them with a hard offer, you can just say the price is a bit more than you budgeted and ask for help with one of the greatest of all-time calibrated questions, how am I supposed to do that? The critical part of this approach is that you really are asking for help and your delivery must convey that. With this negotiating scheme, instead of bullying the clerk, you're asking for their advice and giving them the illusion of control. Asking for help in this manner, after you've already been engaged in a dialogue, is an incredibly powerful negotiating technique for transforming encounters from confrontational showdowns into joint problem-solving sessions. And calibrated questions are the best tool. Calibrate your questions. A few years ago, I was consulting with a client who had a small firm that did public relations for a large corporation. The folks at the big company were not paying their bills, and as time went on, they owed my client more and more money. They kept her on the hook by promising lots of repeat business, implying that she would get a pile of revenue if she just kept working. She felt trapped. My advice for her was simple. I told her to engage them in a conversation where she summarized the situation, and then asked, "How am I supposed to do that?" She shook her head. "No way." The idea of having to ask this question just terrified her. "If they tell me I have to, then I'm trapped," was her reaction. She also heard the question as, "You're screwing me out of money and it has to stop." That sounded like the first step to getting her fired as a consultant. I explained to her that this implication, though real, was in her mind. Her client would hear the words and not the implication, as long as she kept calm and avoided making it sound by her delivery like an accusation or threat. As long as she stayed cool, they would hear it as a problem to be solved. She didn't quite believe me. We walked through the script several times, but she was still afraid. Then, a few days later, she called me, totally giddy with happiness. The client had called with another request, and she had finally gotten up the courage to summarize the situation and ask, "How am I supposed to do that?" And you know what? The answer she got was, "You're right, you can't, and I apologize." Her client explained that they were going through some internal problems, but she was given a new accounting contact and told she'd be paid within 48 hours. And she was. Now think about how my client's question worked. Without accusing them of anything, it pushed the big company to understand her problem and offer the solution she wanted. That, in a nutshell, is the whole point of open-ended questions that are calibrated for a specific effect. Like the softening words and phrases perhaps, maybe, I think, and it seems, the calibrated open-ended question takes the aggression out of a confrontational statement or close-ended request that might otherwise anger your counterpart. What makes them work is that they are subject to interpretation by your counterpart instead of being rigidly defined. They allow you to introduce ideas and requests without sounding overbearing or pushy. And that's the difference between "you're screwing me out of money and it has to stop" and "how am I supposed to do that?" The real beauty of calibrated questions is the fact that they offer no target for attack, like statements do. Calibrated questions have the power to educate your counterpart on what the problem is, rather than causing conflict by telling them what the problem is. But calibrated questions are not just random requests for comment. they have a direction. Once you figure out where you want a conversation to go, you have to design the questions that will ease the conversation in that direction, while letting the other guy think it's his choice to take you there. That's why I refer to these questions as calibrated questions. You have to calibrate them carefully, just like you would calibrate a gun sight or a measuring scale, to target a specific problem. The good news is that there are rules for that. First off, calibrated questions avoid verbs or words like can, is, are, do, or does. These are closed-ended questions that can be answered with a simple yes or a no. Instead, they start with a list of words people know as reporters' questions: who, what, when, where, why, and how. Those words inspire your counterpart to think and then speak expansively. But let me cut the list even further. It's best to start with what, how, and sometimes why. Nothing else. Who, when, and where will often just get your counterpart to share a fact without thinking, and why can backfire. Regardless of what language the word why is translated into, it's accusatory. There are very rare moments when this is to your advantage. The only time you can use why successfully is when the defensiveness that is created supports the change you are trying to get them to see. Why would you ever change from the way you've always done things and try my approach, is an example. Why would your company ever change from your long-standing vendor and choose our company, is another. As always, tone of voice, respectful and deferential, is critical. Otherwise, treat why like a burner on a hot stove. Don't touch it. Having just two words to start with might not seem like a lot of ammunition, but trust me, you can use what and how to calibrate nearly any question. Does this look like something you would like? Can become, how does this look to you? Or, what about this works for you? You can even ask, what about this doesn't work for you? And you'll probably trigger quite a bit of useful information from your counterpart. Even something as harsh as, why did you do it, can be calibrated to, what caused you to do it? Which takes away the emotion and makes the question less accusatory. You should use calibrated questions early and often, and there are a few that you will find that you will use in the beginning of nearly every negotiation. What is the biggest challenge you face is one of those questions. It just gets the other side to teach you something about themselves, which is critical to any negotiation because all negotiation is an information gathering process. Here are some other great standbys that I use in almost every negotiation, depending on the situation. What about this is important to you? How can I help to make this better for us? How would you like me to proceed? What is it that brought us into this situation? How can we solve this problem? What's the objective? What are we trying to accomplish here? How am I supposed to do that? The implication of any well-designed, calibrated question is that you want what the other guy wants, but you need his intelligence to overcome the problem. This really appeals to very aggressive or egotistical counterparts. You've not only implicitly asked for help, triggering goodwill and less defensiveness, but you've engineered a situation in which your formerly recalcitrant counterpart is now using his mental and emotional resources to overcome your challenges. It is the first step in your counterpart internalizing your way, and the obstacles in it, as his own. And that guides the other party toward designing a solution. Your solution. Think back to how the doctor used calibrated questions to get his patient to stay. As his story showed, the key to getting people to see things your way is not to confront them on their ideas, you can't leave, but to acknowledge their ideas openly. I understand why you're pissed off, and then guide them toward solving the problem. What do you hope to accomplish by leaving? Like I said before, the secret to gaining the upper hand in a negotiation is giving the other side the illusion of control. That's why calibrated questions are ingenious. Calibrated questions make your counterpart feel like they're in charge, but it's really you who are framing the conversation. Your counterpart will have no idea how constrained they are by your questions. Once I was negotiating with one of my FBI bosses about attending a Harvard executive program. He had already approved the expenditure for the travel, but on the day before I was supposed to leave, he called me into his office and began to question the validity of the trip. I knew him well enough to know that he was trying to show me that he was in charge. So, after we talked for a while, I looked at him and asked, "When you originally approved this trip, what did you have in mind?"